I have Skype turned all the way up. I have my level turned all the way up.
Hello and welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast, episode number 189. It's Thursday, August 27th,
and we're glad you're here. Today we're going to get a full recap and rundown from BlizzCon from our resident Blizzard expert, Josh Augustine. Josh, glad to have you on the podcast.
Why, hello. It's great to be here.
Fantastic. We also have Dan Stapleton, reviews editor for our magazine, PC Gamer.
Hi, everybody.
And as always, the ski man with the ski mask. I'm looking at his little Skype image here. Andy Bauman, podcast producer.
Yes.
Did you have a stroke? Is that...
Would you like a spot of tea? Yes! People who get that are awesome.
Oh, wow. You're making me laugh too much. All right, fantastic. We're also going to touch on... wasn't a whole lot of news this week. A lot of the news, at least on the blogs and whatnot, was spent on these, you know, price drops and the consoles. A lot of people talking about that. And we're not really interested in that too much, of course. But we are interested in Champions Online coming out this Friday, at least to the pre-orders, if I'm correct, Dan?
Yeah, it's the early access starts tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. If you pre-ordered the game, then you can get a weekend's head start on everybody else who gets to get in on Tuesday, I guess, September 1st.
All right, so the Champions Online folks at Cryptic had rolled out a lifetime subscription program, $200 if you wanted to pay, you know, no monthly subscriptions for the entirety that the game was available online. I guess they had a limited amount of those. I wasn't really familiar with this.
Basically they posted on their site that you could get this, and initially they said there was a limited quantity of these subscriptions that they were selling. So people started snapping them up. And I guess in subsequent posts they didn't mention that there was a limited quantity, so people got really upset when they ran out. They are actually doing pretty well with this game. You know, the excitement is starting to build up for it. So people were buying up these $200 lifetime subscriptions, as well as some 6-month subscription offers they had for a discount. That also, and both of these, well, by the way, also give you guaranteed access to the upcoming Star Trek Online beta, the closed beta. So not just anybody can waltz into that one. So people got pretty upset because they wanted to cash in on that. So Cryptic has now through August 31st, which is a few days from now, you can now get a lifetime subscription or a 6-month subscription if you act quickly.
Wow.
Which, yeah, it's great news that it's getting that much excitement.
Now, there was another game that had, I hear, that had lifetime subscriptions.
There was. There was a lifetime subscription offer for Hellgate London, which turned out to be a lifetime of the game and not your lifetime.
Oh.
So, and that kind of raises the question of, you know, is it really worth it to buy a lifetime subscription for an MMO?
First of all, you do get a lot of bonuses too, like the Star Trek Online. You get 8 additional character slots. You get like vanity pets and extra costumes in the game. So there is that kind of bonus, but I mean, $15 a month. I assume that Champions is going to be the kind of the standard $15 a month.
Yeah,
that adds up really fast. I've been playing World of Warcraft since release. You know, it's almost 5 years now. I added up. I've spent $870 on World of Warcraft subscriptions.
Ooh, I bet you. I bet you wish you didn't just do that addition.
Yeah, I wish they had this option on World of Warcraft. Yeah, I mean, $200. I mean, that looks like a great deal. So I mean, it's about you, if you play for at least a year, you'll break even. So if you think you're going to be playing more than a year, you'll
actually do better than that, because if 200 is, it includes the game, I believe. So you're getting $50 worth of game for the shelf price of the game. And then, that leaves $150, which divided by 10 is $15 a month. So that's 10 months. So if you're going to play for longer than 10 months, then you've broken even.
Yeah, and I mean, anybody that's played in the beta, I mean, you should have an idea whether this is the type of game that you enjoy. And if you're into this type of MMO, I mean, I don't see why you wouldn't want to be in there for at least 10 months.
It's also, you know, Cryptic has a pretty good track record, with, you know, City of Heroes, in that, you know, that game's been going for 4 or 5 years now. And, you know, that's a pretty big value right there if you had a lifetime subscription based on that.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm thinking about this from the standpoint of like server maintenance and stuff. If they have a revenue stream coming in every month, then they know what they can spend. But if everybody just buys up front, like 3 years down the road, and they need to do a big overhaul of technology or something, are they like, oh?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously they can't offer that to everybody. That's why they're doing it, you know, for a limited time and a limited number of them initially. So that's after the 31st. So unless you're like super enthusiastic about it and are an early adopter, you're not going to get in on this. Anybody and you know, that's kind of a smart strategy too, because you give the really enthusiastic people, and even, you know, another reason to be really enthusiastic about it. It's like, oh, I'm really invested in this game right from the get-go. I'm going to tell all my friends about it and try and get them into it. And those are the guys that are going to join and pay the $15 a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because naturally, I mean, those investment levels do vary, especially for an MMO. And those, like you said, those people that have played in the beta and followed the game's development and, you know, kept a close eye on the developer's blog. So it's a good way of, you know, offering that to fans that they can act on immediately, like a collector's edition in other games cases, I guess.
Yeah, so Dan, you mentioned that they're going to get the game with this. Do you know if they're going to get like a box shipped to them? Because it would be kind of a bummer if, like, if you are a big fan, you kind of want to go buy the collector's edition or something. Do you get any sort of tangible thing that you can hold or put on your desk?
You know, I'm not certain. And actually, let me go back and absolutely verify that you do get the box with it, or that you do get the game included with that $200.
Now, the next step in the MMO realm would be for them to pay you to play.
That's where
it is like a job, I hear.
Right. Sometimes. Well, in some cases, you might see a model come up where there are opportunities for players to earn money within the game.
Like be an actor.
Yeah, could be. It would be kind of cool. I mean, Josh, don't you think there are a bunch of WoW players who would really enjoy kind of a part-time job where they do like role-playing in the game?
Oh, yes. I can't even imagine. Matrix Online actually did something like that where, you know, players kind of took over the parts of famous NPC characters and were acting. They weren't paid. They were volunteer. But I know they really loved that.
Right.
Oh, what is that? Student film BS. Did they get free lunch at least?
Maybe they got free subscriptions. That's possible.
Oh, that'd be cool. That'd be great.
Okay, so I did just hear from Cryptic that you do have to. The $200 does not include the price of the game, so it's a $250 outlay, which is still, you know, it's still about a year's worth of gameplay. I guess a little like what's 200 divided by 15? Anybody? Math whizzes?
Like what?
13 maybe?
Calc.exe.
It's 13.333 months. So yeah, it's still, you know, a year's worth of playtime. If you're planning to play more than a year, then it's still worth it.
Yeah. So Josh, speaking of Blizzard, I heard that you're our only guy at BlizzCon last week and you had a wonderful time.
Yes, I did. It was my first BlizzCon ever, which I was a little sad to say. I've been trying to buy tickets, you know, past years, but as, I think it was Greg Street was saying it during the intro speech, the tickets for this year's BlizzCon sold out in 30 seconds. It took them 15 minutes to process the orders, but if you hadn't placed your order in the first 30 seconds they went online, you didn't get them.
Wow.
And how many people were there, estimated?
I believe it's 20,000 tickets, so I imagine it's got to be pretty close to that.
And so close to that amount of people, conceivably, were just hitting F5.
Yes.
Right before they came out. Wow.
And do you know if they had...
Sorry, do you know if they have any controls over like scalping? Do they limit the number of tickets one person can buy?
Yeah, the first year was really bad with scalping, so they've kind of been implementing stuff since then. You can only buy three at a time, and you can't have your tickets mailed to you or shipped to you. You have to show up with your ID, and it has to match the name on the credit card that purchased the tickets at the convention, and then they hand you the ticket. So they do a pretty good job. I mean, potentially scalpers could go there, pick up the tickets, and then try and sell them on the street. But I mean, if you're going to pay some guy ahead of time, assuming that he's going to show up at BlizzCon and meet you with the tickets, I mean, that's so sketchy. I would just expect to have your money stolen at that point.
Yeah, so don't get it on Craigslist is what you're saying.
Yes.
But Josh, I think what I'm most interested in, we saw the monk character class for Diablo 3 revealed. Really exciting for me. It just seems like a nice, interesting, and again, to mention it, you predicted that, for the WoW Cataclysm expansion, monk would be the new hero class, but it's actually in Diablo 3, so you're sort of half right.
Exactly. I did tally up my, how well I did with those predictions. I gave myself half a point for the monk guess.
That seems fair.
What were the rest of them? What were those, your scores on that?
I was a little less than halfway. I was like 5.5 to 6, getting 5.5 right. I got, you know, Goblin Worgens. I didn't really count that because that was so obvious. Everyone knew at that point.
How noble.
Cataclysm. Emerald Dream definitely got wrong. I still think that's going to be like maybe one of the major content patches, or they're going to save it for the next expansion, but that's where the story's headed for sure. Recreate Azeroth, got that one. Thrall Disappearing, got that one. Grosh, I said he's going to be the Lich King. He's now the leader of the Horde. But he's using all the Lich King's iron and all of his metal and like the Lich King's power to recreate Orgrimmar. So that's still kind of sketchy. I'm not sold on that. Mafurion Stormrage, got that one. And a couple other things. So overall, not bad. I'm not terribly impressed with my foreknowledge, but I'm not ashamed.
That's good. That's good. All right. So yeah, getting back to the monk.
Yes, the monk.
I think it's an amazing trailer, personally. Like, what a way to reveal a character and pretty much using in-game assets, it looks like. I mean, it sort of sold me more on the engine, the art style.
Yeah, it appeared to be all in-engine animation, which was surprising to me because, I mean, Blizzard has such a history of doing, you know, these elaborate CGI trailers.
Exactly. Yeah. He's obviously customized stuff, but what were your impressions playing with him, Josh?
He is really fun. I have to say, he's kind of my type of class. I love kind of the agile, high damage melee DPS kind of guy. He was really fun. He has that teleport ability. I forget what it's called. But basically, he like teleports around an area, punching everybody in the face one time, just like instantly killing them. And it's just incredible. It's incredibly bloody, just running around and like six people just explode all around you. He has, you know, one move, you know, just automatically guarantees you dodge the next attack on you. So there is some tactical stuff there where if you see a big power-up move coming, you can move to dodge it. He has a lot of spell reflection, which should be really interesting for dealing with ranged casters. Yeah, he just plays so well. It's so brutal and up close. And like the monk, you know, he's got the staff, so he's not totally unarmed. But it's really his spells are incredible.
That's cool. I really like the idea of more of these sort of unconventional classes within Diablo, you know, less of like paladins and I guess they have the wizard already, but, you know, more along the lines of the witch doctor and the monk, things that sort of create new ideas of what classes are and what mechanics they should employ.
Yeah, they're doing a real good job of kind of keeping it similar enough that when I jumped in, I knew exactly what I should do and how to play. I didn't have to figure out, okay, what is this class like? But there's enough of a twist that it's, okay, this is not, you know, the rogue from WoW or, you know, the monk from another game. It's got its own specialties. It's really, really good balance.
Excellent. Glad to hear it.
Anything StarCraft 2 newsy?
Well, I'd never played the StarCraft 2 single player. I know Dan had ahead of time. So that was really fun. I love being able to walk around the ship in between your missions. It reminded me a bit of Mass Effect almost, where you're walking around talking with your teammates and they're commenting on, you know, the last mission, what they thought, how did it affect them? And, you know, you stop by the computer and upgrade your stim packs for your space marines. And I think that's a really nice touch.
Anything you want to talk about, like the culture of BlizzCon or World of Warcraft?
Yeah, BlizzCon is really, everyone was really nice. You know, I expected, you know, just because when you're running around WoW, I mean, there's always jerks. And so I was expecting, you know, kind of some, you know, people shoving their way, trying to, you know, get to the front of the line, get their stuff because they don't really care. Everyone was really nice. Only at BlizzCon, where people have been trained by World of Warcraft to grind stuff like crazy, would people stand in line for like an hour
waiting for some just drops.
They gave you a quest and you had to like stop at 5 different booths and pick up like fishing lures. Then if you collected all 5, you get like a reward when you turn in the quest. Like each one of the lines was like an hour long. God. I have to admit that I waited in them. So I'm just as bad as the rest of them. One of them, I waited till the Aussie concert. And so it was totally empty. So I got right through it, but I waited in a bunch of them and then you go turn it in, and you get like a sticker. And, you know,
was there a sign that said, leave the griefing online? Like as you entered the show floor.
No, but there should have been.
Damn.
Did they tell you ahead of time what the prize was?
No, of course not. You had to, there was like a bag and you had to pick a jewel out of it. And the jewels were colored based on like the gear levels in the game. So, you know, if you got a gray, it was like you got the sticker. But if you got like a green, maybe you could get it like a patch or a sticker. And if you got a blue, which I got, you could get like any of those, or you could get like a little manga book. And then if you got like an epic, you got something really cool. But I didn't see anybody get an epic.
Man.
I think there was like two a day or something.
Wow.
I don't know how I feel about that. Like, as a general rule, I like scavenger hunting. But when, like you said, it is what you do in game, essentially, for a lot of your quests. And then you're paying to come to this amazing, you know, celebration of the game and you know, hang out with other players. And they make you... or incentivize you to hunt around to get stuff and get swag.
Well, to be fair, you're paying to play the game. Booths. It was one of the booths running this, so this wasn't a Blizzard thing.
Okay.
It's like an advertisement for one of the booths.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Josh.
Yeah.
We're going down to Anaheim, working hard for us.
I have a couple more things to comment on, actually.
Oh,
if you got time.
Absolutely.
I'm not a huge Ozzy Osbourne fan. I stayed for the, you know, the concert just for fun, to see what it is like. He pulled out a fire extinguisher and started shooting everybody in the front rows with it. And
isn't that toxic?
Yeah.
Well, depends on the fire extinguisher.
<That's Yeah. true. laughs>
Newer ones are probably safe, and I doubt he would have sprayed anybody with anything too toxic.
Yeah, and he did splash them with buckets of water afterwards. So, you know, clean off. And then
were these fans on fire? Because if so, then all that was justified.
Figuratively.
He might have thought they were. I don't know. He looked kind of crazy. And then, but then the best, my favorite part was he brought out that Yuto Miyazawa. It's like the 9-year-old Japanese kid who plays guitar like outrageously well. And so that was really fun. He just like shows up on stage and you know, he's so happy just to be there with Ozzy. And Ozzy like picks him up and puts him on his shoulder and starts running around. And it was pretty awesome. And then the other highlight was the costume contest for me, because I'm the kind of guy that I would never get dressed up in a costume and go to one of these things. It's just not my thing. But I love to see other people that do it. Like the lady that won had spent 500 hours on her costume as a Diablo 2 character. I haven't played Diablo 2, so I'm not sure, but it was crazy looking. And I found out that there was a crocodile and like a hunter, and the crocodile's running around on stage. I found out that was my friend from high school afterwards. So that was kind of fun. I saw him on stage. I was like, man, that guy is crazy. And then he's like, oh, did you see that crocodile? That was me and my wife on stage. So that was kind of fun afterwards.
What a guy.
Yeah. I mean, hey, he got on stage at BlizzCon. I mean, that's saying something, right?
That was your claim to fame right there, Josh.
Yeah.
I went to high school with that guy.
I can imagine him saying that to the guy next to him. Hey, I know that crocodile.
We go way back. And actually, that is probably the only place where bragging about knowing a crocodile might actually impress some people.
I don't know. Actually, I think bragging about knowing an actual crocodile, that would impress me.
What about a CrocCon 2009? What, no
is,
good?
As
no
long
good?
As it's not about the shoes, because those things are ugly as anything.
All right, real quickly, we're going to hit on this last bit of news that might be of interest to you guys. Unfortunately, there's a couple announcements that Raven Software and Maxis had both laid off employees earlier this week. For Raven, according to one source, according to shacknews.com, the number of firings at 56 employees out of a previous total of 180. So that's pretty significant for Raven itself, who had developed, was it X-Men Origins Wolverine?
The
actual title.
They also did all the X-Men Legend games,
Quake 4,
of course, and Soldier of Fortune, and they're currently working on Singularity.
Yep, and it most recently, last week, of course, put out Wolfenstein.
Yeah,
right. Well, the single player portion of Wolfenstein.
Right.
The guys who did the multiplayer portion of Wolfenstein had their own layoffs like the week before, didn't they?
They did indeed. The entire studio, or most of the studio.
I don't think they closed it. I think it was just layoffs. But you know, it's always
too bad.
Always sad to see that. I mean, but when you think about it, like a big studio just finishes like a big project, and then they've got like, if they don't have another project lined up, then they've got a bunch of people sitting there that were needed at the height of development, that are now just sitting there spinning their wheels if they don't have a project to launch into. Mm-hmm. So, and it's entirely possible that they'll bring these people back as soon as they gear up for another. I mean, they'll definitely have to bring a lot of people back when they gear up for another round of development. But I guess at the moment they don't have another project. But,
and that seemed to be the case. That's kind of what reflected what they said about, you know, we just don't have as many projects right now. And seems the case for Maxis at EA, the Sims folks and the Spore folks as well, who they didn't really announce exactly how many people were laid off, but they just said, you know, often in the video game industry, the size of a studio fluctuates in response to business conditions, and we can assume that's along the same lines.
Although we should clarify there that the Maxis is not making the current Sims stuff. They, right. That EA has their own entire new like Sims division.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a moneymaker for them that they spun that off into its own studio. So Maxis did not make The Sims 3, and they aren't making the expansions for that. So.
Oh, really?
If Activision gets their way and starts charging $60 for PC games, does that mean less layoffs?
Potentially. But at the same time, these are all corporations, so they're always driving to make the most money possible.
Right.
So they want to charge as much as they can and spend as little as they can while still producing games that people want to buy. So it's a balancing act. I mean, ideally, they would certainly hire more people to produce more games that they can then sell for more money.
This kind of leads into this topic we have in the agenda about development culture. You know, does this breed a good culture for development teams? Like, because you've got to become incredibly close. I don't really know for sure, but I mean, right?
Well, I mean, this is nothing new. I mean, this has been going on, you know, the whole life of game development, pretty much. I mean, except when games were made
cold.
In people's garages.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain teams that have probably been together for a long time, and those cultures probably breed excellent games, whereas teams that are just thrown together every time there's a project and then disbanded, who knows, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's not even just the culture itself. It's a developer that develops a proficiency for certain things. I mean, in the case of Raven, after reviewing Wolfenstein, you can definitely see tons of Soldier of Fortune in that game, in the detail of the gore and dismembering enemies, how entertaining enemies feel. And, you know, I don't know specifically who they lost, but you got to think that there's value in, you know, maintaining, like, you know, what a developer can do well over time. You know, Valve tells, you know, great stories in Portal and Half-Life 2, for example, and they would want to hold on to those people.
Yeah, I mean, you got to keep in mind that these layoffs aren't random, and you know, no disrespect to anybody who was laid off, but
no, not at all.
I'm sure they're keeping the key people that will, you know, that will carry over the Raven field to the next games.
So on the topic of developers, I wanted to play an interesting question we got from a listener earlier this week, a little bit ahead of schedule, and get our thoughts on what the best developer ever may be.
That's kind of a huge question, isn't it? I mean, it's you've got to take into account, like, are they the guys that made in your opinion, the best game ever? Or are they the guys that consistently make the best game, like really good games, even if they haven't made your favorite game? You know, there's a lot of different ways to approach that question.
There's a lot of different ways indeed. Let's think about why you played the question itself. Yep.
Hey guys, Colby from Salt Lake City here. The question I have for you is this: who is the greatest game developer of all time? I know Evan is going to say Valve, but Evan, you're wrong. For my money, it's got to be Blizzard or BioWare. Nobody puts out games as polished as Blizzard does, and every game they create literally sets the bar for that specific genre. Everyone compares all hack and slashers to Diablo. Everyone compares all MMOs to WoW, RTSs, StarCraft, etc. BioWare, on the other hand, creates the most emotionally satisfying games. From KOTOR to Mass Effect and everything in between, I care more about what happens to the characters in BioWare's games than any other developer, and I rejoice more loudly at their triumphs. Finishing a BioWare game feels really, really good because they create the greatest stories and characters. Every game that both of these companies puts out is a classic. Not many developers can say as much. What do you think? Oh, and also, when are you guys going to get Deathlock on the podcast? We need some more RPG love. Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Oh, man.
We actually just sent Deathlock a headset. So maybe we'll be able to get him on here sooner
nice.
Or later. He's,
dude,
he's like, we were going to have him on a couple times, but like at the last minute, he like, oh, my headset doesn't work. So, but yeah, maybe in the future. He's a busy guy.
He can't talk with a cigar in his mouth.
That's right. All right. So great question, obviously. A big question that we can't possibly hope to condense to under 10 minutes, but we'll try to. Rebutting some of the BioWare comments.
Screw you.
Yeah.
Dude, I love BioWare, though. Come on.
Yeah. No, nothing against BioWare. I love BioWare.
Yeah.
Just personally, I don't think BioWare, at least in Mass Effect, I don't think they did combat well in that game, but broader, you know, across the entire slate of their games, at least in recent history, if you're talking about KOTOR and Mass Effect and now Dragon Age, in the last topic, we were talking about, like, you know, developer developing competency for certain things that they do well. They sort of apply the same things, you know, among those three games. There's dialogue system, there's morality,
there's definitely parties, that Jedi.
Party system, there's romance, you know, epic story.
There's like a version of a Jedi in each storyline.
The great warden inspectors and
but
Jedi.
All those things you just listed are what make a game great. So why wouldn't you want to have those in all games?
I think they're good. You know, like, they're definitely excellent. They make excellent games, but in the sense that they're replicating what they do well. So if you're talking about complete originality in terms of mechanics and like the formula that a developer uses to make a game, you know, maybe you take that into account.
Well, the mechanics for Mass Effect were completely different from or very different anyway from KOTOR or from Baldur's Gate.
Were they?
Yeah. I mean, it was much more of a, I mean, for one thing, it was kind of ranged combat. And more of a third person shooter almost. Whereas
a party system, there's loot, you know.
There's party systems, but I'm saying that the combat was different. And of course, saying like anybody who is specialized in one particular type of game is going to keep doing what they do well. And why would they do anything different? And as for there being a version of Jedi in all their games, I mean, there's a version of Jedi in just about every game. It's called the hero. I mean, it's anything that has magical powers. I mean, there are versions of Jedi essentially in Blizzard games. They're wizards, you know. That's kind of a flawed argument, in my opinion.
I don't know. If you're talking about Blizzard, I'd say they pull more from the Games Workshop library of content more than anything. I mean, orcs
and Tolkien,
Zerg, yeah, of course. And to rebut the comment on Valve that I would choose Valve, I'm not sure if that's the case for me. I think one way of thinking about Valve is they're the best talent scouts in the industry, right? I mean,
definitely.
They pulled the modder team for Counter-Strike and made that into an excellent product. They pulled
Team Fortress team,
Portal as well.
Left 4 Dead
as well.
All of those were external projects that they brought in.
I mean,
and they.
I mean, if you're talking about a best developer, or are you talking about someone that holds special in your mind, like your favorite, or are we talking some sort of like methodology of deciding what's the best developer by coming up with like metrics for that? Like, what do you? I don't know what to do for that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking across the spectrum of their entire library. You know, who's been the most consistent and innovative at the same time, hopefully.
I really, I'm not sure you can really argue against Blizzard if those are the rules. I mean, you can say, you know, they borrowed, you know, the lore from Games Workshop. But I mean, they took something that wasn't really, it wasn't a video game. It wasn't a good video game at all and made it the best in its genre. And they did that, you know, three or four times in different genres. I just don't think you.
I mean, just to back you up there, Josh, saying that anybody borrowed anything from anywhere is and as a criticism against them is that shouldn't even be a factor. I mean, everything is derivative of something. You know, that's just not even a concern in my mind.
Right, but how much this derivative is important, right?
Well, I mean, if you name your game and you can find sources where they borrowed a lot of stuff from. I mean, just about everything has been taken from something else. I mean, artists borrow from each other all the time. That's kind of how it's done. If it's a matter of actually ripping somebody off and taking their stuff word for word, that's one thing. But nobody's done that in this group here.
Yeah, and we're talking about borrowing kind of lore and setting, which I would argue wasn't Game Workshop originally. But gameplay-wise, I mean, they came up with all that stuff. So gameplay-wise and making a fun game that plays well, I mean, Blizzard, you can't blame Blizzard for ripping off anybody on that stuff.
Yeah, I think we can certainly say Blizzard is one of the most successful. If I wanted a level of criticism against them, I'd say they're relatively risk-averse. Obviously, they kill games that they don't think are going to do well, StarCraft Ghost and a few others. And you know, that's not a slight against them. It's just a matter of they only release things that they know are going to be incredibly successful.
Now, that's good business.
Right. But is that a good developer?
Why not?
That's a good publisher.
I like the idea of coming up with your best developer just on your feelings about something, you know? Like, so I love BioWare games, right? But I thought The Witcher, as, you know, flawed as it was a better RPG than any BioWare's made, you know? Because of, like, the risks it took, the craziness, and the choices were all really dark. And I thought that was, like, a way more interesting game than anything BioWare's done. But I still love BioWare. So, who's better? CD Projekt is better than BioWare? I don't think so. But do I love The Witcher more than a BioWare game? Yes.
By the way, I'd like to throw Relic into this mix. For me, they're one of the great RTS developers between Homeworld and Company of Heroes and Warhammer. They've won two PC Gamer Game of the Year awards, which few other people besides Blizzard and Valve have ever done.
Yeah.
Certainly. A great candidate.
Yeah.
I'd also like to throw in Ensemble Studios just because I was in love with them for like my first 5 years of gaming. Age of Empires like dominated my life, and Bruce Shelley was like a god to me for years. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah, there are so many criteria on this, and like this is one of those arguments that we have kind of yearly here whenever we go over like the game of the year arguments.
Yeah.
And those meetings often last for hours. So we should probably move on.
So everybody throw out some their favorites.
I just did.
Ensemble or Relic for you. Mm. I would say, I don't know, right now, Telltale. Ha!
That's good. For me, I mean, it fluctuates. I don't know if I can choose, but I've been playing so much Armor right now. I have a really deep appreciation for what Bohemia does. I mean, what they're able to...
Are you prepared to call them the greatest developer ever?
I'm not.
That's sort of like that's really
that's what the question is.
That's really along the lines of what I was talking about. Like Arma is this really cool risk-taking game that's like got all these flaws, but you love it so much.
Yeah.
That's what I feel. That's why I love Vampire the Masquerade so much too. It's like, man, that game has so much flaws, but I love it so much.
But this isn't a question about what game do you really like. This is a question.
Sure.
What developers are you willing to throw into the pot for best developer ever?
Okay. I was going to say Bethesda, but I hate their animators is what I was going to say. I hate a lot of their textures and games. Gosh, I don't want to say Valve because the guy said I would say Valve.
No, well, they are a great
Valve,
developer.
There's no reason
they should not be considered for best developer ever, even though, as you said, they you know, aside from the Half-Life games, which are brilliant, they do much of their success has come from bringing external people into their fold, and that makes them better developers by finding the better people and adding them to their collective. So that makes them great developers.
It's true. I think I definitely credit Valve as well for getting this concept of iteration, you know, constant iteration within the industry and within the consumer base a lot, just bring awareness to that concept. If you saw our feature, I guess it was back in August, our August issue, where we showed off some of the Left 4 Dead character art, Left 4 Dead 2 character art for the Charger and Coach and how they iterated on those characters and just developed them over time. And if you saw, they did a video last week for the one of the King of the Hill maps they just showed for Team Fortress 2, and they showed all the changes they made within that level, you know, in a time-lapse video. I just like the way they present their ideas as kind of academic. Josh, did you say Blizzard? I think you did.
Yeah, I'd go with Blizzard. I really do enjoy BioWare as well. I agree with a lot of what the caller said.
And Andy, would you actually say that Telltale is one of the best developers ever?
See, this is my dilemma, is that I want to hug Telltale more than I want to hug Valve or Blizzard, but to say that they're the best developer is probably not accurate.
Might be a bit of a stretch. Nothing against those guys. I just played the second Monkey Island. Great game, but I mean, I'm not prepared to call them.
I know, right? But I'd much rather like give them a high five than Blizzard.
right now just because you're high on the game you just played. Yes.
Fine. But, you know me so
but
well.
What is... I know that's kind of a knee-jerk reaction. You know, it's, I just played that.
That's what I'm all about, man. I'm all about my knee-jerk reaction, going from the gut.
That's what Evan was just talking about. Arma is his flavor of the last couple of months.
Yeah.
But
for me, it is Valve, I guess. Yeah. Just for all the stuff that they do.
Cool.
Fair enough.
Very good. All right. So moving on to some less emotionally charged arguments, I want to bring in some other best of candidates on some more obscure topics, hopefully, that we can have a little bit more fun with. I'll just kick it right off to you guys, sort of like a lightning round style. So feel free to be quick and be quick with your judgments here. So what game has the best ragdoll that you've played?
There was something recently I played that was just really good, but I can't remember what it was.
Raven Squad?
God, no.
Trials.
Oh, Trials.
Oh, yeah. That was some excellent ragdoll.
That's some good stuff.
I enjoyed Oblivion because you could, you know, grab
them up.
Certain parts on their body and just kind of wiggle them around.
That was good.
That's a good one. I'd throw in a Counter-Strike Source. Still some of the best tech within that engine, I think.
I'm going to have to pass on it just because I can't remember that game that I'm thinking of.
Oh, that's quite fine. Next one, best jetpack in a game.
I really like the San Andreas jetpack.
Ooh.
Because you could do missions, like you could come up with your own way to solve a mission.
And totally break it, basically.
Yeah, and wear a suit and be James Bond with a jetpack.
Yeah, you would be able to just go, like, the mission would be, you know, go, you know, do this one thing, but you have to fight your way through all these guys, and you just fly over them.
It's
kind of a mission-breaking thing that was just kind of fun.
It was.
I like the jump jet infantry in Dawn of War 2. Where you can just launch over any obstacle and land in the middle of guys and send them flying. That was a lot of fun. I know exactly what Evan's going to say.
Good old Thaddeus. No, that is a good one because, I mean, they had to pay a lot of attention to that effect because you're using it so constantly if you're using that squad.
Yep.
I mean, it's kind of your bread and butter, honestly. At least it was for me.
Yeah, I actually went through the single player again and, like, deliberately made myself not use that because I felt I was relying on it too much.
Yeah, good for you. It does kind of break some of the cover mechanics. Anyway, but yeah, you know what I'm going to say. Tribes, Starseed.
Yep.
Starseed Tribes. The nuance of having a game where you can use the physics system to ski against hills with a jump pack and fantastic. Next one, best energy weapon.
All right, now you guys are going to have to remind me, because when I energy weapon, I immediately thought of the flat cannon in Unreal Tournament. I'm not really sure if that was technically an energy weapon, but like the stuff bounced off walls, so I think it was.
Well, wouldn't energy not bounce off walls unless the walls were like mirrors?
Maybe they were.
It's matter that is bouncing off stuff. So yeah, think again, Josh.
Ah,
best energy weapon, hands down, lightsaber.
Oh, nice.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting choice. Game came out of sideways, yeah. I'm going to go with a recent one. The I don't know if I can pronounce this, the Leichenfaust 44 from Wolfenstein. Basically,
I've
it's
heard
an
good things about that.
Yes, you have. It's basically a energy sort of cannon. Shoots this, you know, orb that not only turns guys into skeletons and like ash, but like basically degravitizes an area when you shoot that area. So you're seeing these rising bodies of, you know, bones and ash just floating in the air, and then they collapse a few seconds later. It's pretty satisfying.
Which actually kind of reminds me of Crusader, the old Crusader games. They had some awesome energy weapons in that. They would vaporize people and turn them to ash or goo, all that kind of stuff. Very satisfying. Same with the Fallout 1 and 2 plasma rifle melting people. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Fallout 3's plasma rifle was just pretty good.
All right, how about the most balanced game? Single player or multiplayer? Well, I guess more emphasis on multiplayer would be better.
And you really kind of have to give that to the original StarCraft, don't you?
Could be.
Or
I would agree.
Warcraft 3.
Really? What? Why would you say Warcraft 3 is more balanced than StarCraft?
Because of the heroes and the creeping and purchasing
that makes
the
it
item.
More balanced?
I don't know, it makes it more interesting.
It's cool. It's cool. It's a cool mechanic, but is it necessarily more balanced?
I don't know, Dan.
I mean, can we convincingly say all three races in StarCraft can be played just as effectively?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. And Blizzard has gone to great lengths to make sure that happens, and that's why it is, you know, such a widely played competitive game, is that it is so meticulously balanced. And balancing three sides with mechanics as different as those against each other is really, really hard.
Yeah, I would say, especially at this point, having so many years to balance it, I mean, I don't think any game can compete with that.
Yeah. Josh, you're kind of soft again.
Maybe StarCraft 2, but who knows?
Yeah, we'll see. All right, next one. Best mod, either a full conversion or a add-on.
All the best mods have become games, really.
Yeah.
And mostly Valve games. Yeah, what else? That's kind of racking my brain here. Like my mod
Desert Combat for Battlefield was so good, but it basically became Battlefield 2.
And also those guys went on to make Frontline. Fuel of War.
Yeah.
Yeah, Frontline's Fuel of War, and they're Chaos Studios now, I guess. Which yep. I guess, you know, didn't quite recapture the same glory.
I was so good at Desert Combat.
Excellent.
I was a big fan of the Warlords Star Wars Warlords mod for Homeworld 2. That was very impressive.
That's kind of funny. I've pretty much been playing MMOs almost like exclusively for so long. I can't even remember like the last mod that I downloaded because, you know, it's just illegal to mod MMOs.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have interface mods, right?
Yeah, I guess if you want to count that, that's not really like a game mod, though. It's kind of, yeah.
It's an interface modification.
Then Quest Helper. Quest Helper is the greatest invention of all time.
I'm going to go ahead and throw in Gary's mod, of course, who's spawned tons of machinima. Excellent machinima. If you've ever seen a guy named DJY1991 on YouTube, and it's kind of an obscure name, but he does some excellent fun stuff like reenacting Billy Mays, Gary's mod servers using, what do you call it, like soundboards and things like that. In terms of add-ons, I'm going to throw in the Hunter City. It's sort of a map, I guess, but it definitely remakes the experience in Left 4 Dead, sort of an obstacle course that you run as a hunter that I had a ton of fun with. Okay, next one, best box art.
Oh, this one's—I mean, I don't know. This one's hard.
I give up.
That is pretty tricky.
Can you remember like a bad game that like you were completely sold on because of the box art? I don't know. That's tough. I can definitely throw. This might not be the best, but SimCity 2000.
There you go.
It has that landscape. There's a river running, flowing through. There's that spaceship on the front. That's just very, you know, 90s for whatever reason. That really caught my eye when I was younger, distinctly.
I mean, box art is just so samey.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it is.
Yeah.
I was a big fan of the Homeworld box art, the original Homeworld. It just had the spaceship, and it just kind of captured the essence of the game for me. Homeworld 2's box art, not so much, because it had that they were going for more of a character emphasis on the kind of the brain of the ship, like the woman who was the brain of the ship. Right. And she didn't really appear in the game that much, so it didn't really resonate with me as much.
I remember like having the strategy guide for that game and taking it to dinner with my parents while we were ordering food, and I just read it, things like that.
Wow. Nice.
What a fun game.
The Splinter Cell Chaos Theory box is cool because I think I have the collector's edition, but it's tin, and it's all like beveled, and it's got just Splinter Cell guy on it. It's got Sam Fisher. It's tin, though, so it's cheating, I guess.
Not quite. Texture counts.
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of like the GTA boxes too, where it's kind of the mural of all the different people and kind of vehicles and stuff. I think that's kind of fun.
Yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm. Very good. All right, how about the best Gibbs? Do we call them Gibbs or Jibs? Gibbs.
I've always called them Gibbs. Yes. I don't know.
Me too.
I go with Gibbs, yeah.
Quick one. Cool.
Soldier of Fortune 1.
I'm going to go with TF2. Honestly, when you have that freeze cam after you kill somebody and there's a little like pop-up caption that says your liver or their liver.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
I know, Soldier of Fortune, you could slow down time using the console and then use one of the heavy machine guns to cut enemies into 9 pieces before they hit the ground.
Wow.
9.
So,
specifically
yes.
9. That's
yeah.
Significant.
You blow off their feet, you hit them at the knees, then at the thigh, you know, you take off the thigh, and then you take off the hands, elbows, shoulders, and head. So I think that totals up 9 pieces.
Terrible.
You're a terrible person.
And yet awesome. And you kind of have to do it in order too, because once if you just sever the arm, then you can't shoot the severed arm and break that into the 3 pieces. You have to hit it in order, break them off from, you know, small pieces at a time.
It's like a mini game.
Yeah.
Wonderful. How about best unit slogan in an RTS? So in other words, when you produce a unit or you select a unit in RTS, the thing they say.
Ooh.
My favorite one is Age of Empires, when the little villagers, Rogan?
what language is that?
Crazy cave person Latin? Speak.
Cave person? Oh, right, the cave people. I mean, you've also got to kind of give that one to Blizzard, I think. They've got a lot of like goofy things, especially if you keep clicking on units. They come up with funny things to say.
Yeah. StarCraft 2 has some fun ones. I can't quite recall them, but the MCVs are particularly funny.
Yeah, you know, I actually didn't try that when I was playing. That
was MCVs.
Gross oversight on my part, not to click on the units a bunch.
I do like the most recent Riddler 3 game, the conscript units from the Russians.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They say, what is it like? This is nice coat. Because they're basically like pulled off the street Russian guys and like, oh, I'm in the military. I get this coat.
That was funny. I really like the mission where you have to go like assassinate the emperor, I think, and all you have is like a conscript and a bear.
Yeah.
And he just keeps talking up about the bear every time you click on him and tell him to move.
We did that mission together. Was I the bear? I can't remember.
Yeah, I think you were.
I was the bear. Wonderful. Okay, how about, this might be a little bit difficult, best keyboard command in a game? Doesn't have to be complex, but...
Attack move in any RTS.
Nice.
Yes.
What about F9? Quick save.
Quick save.
It's valuable. If there was a Hall of Fame for keyboard commands, it would go in there. Come on.
Quick save. Oh, yeah, yeah. For sure.
What about F10, though?
Reload.
In some games, it's just bad. Quit, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Sometimes when you quick load, it's hated because you're like, no.
But don't you often try and get people to quit out of like a Team Fortress 2 server by telling them to push F10?
We do. Indeed, it happens. All right, just a couple more. Best explosions.
World in Conflict. The nuke in World in Conflict was awesome. And also Fallout 3's nuke when Megaton goes up. That's a brilliant nuke.
I really liked Duke Nukem 3D's original pipe bombs.
I'm gonna have to go with Arma, not surprisingly, but just this subtle detail where if something explodes, you hear it first, or you see it first, excuse me, and then you hear it, you know, X seconds later, depending on the distance. Just that little detail definitely surprised me.
I like that.
You know, that's true. I haven't played that much Arma, but I watched a video of it where somebody had rigged up this enormous battle on YouTube, and the explosions on that looked like something off of like watching CNN. It was pretty impressive explosions.
Yeah, the way they animate and the way they're textured or the particle effect, whatever you want to call it, it definitely looks better from afar than up close, but it can be pretty atmospheric in that way.
Right, and the smoke that comes off of it is very impressive.
Mm-hmm. Here's what should be an easy one, best cinematic sequence.
Should be easy.
I think so. They're very memorable.
I actually have a terrible memory for that kind of thing.
Oh, really?
But, you know, once again, Blizzard is pretty impressive in that field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I still remember the one where Thrall, and I think it's Grom Hellscream, I think, battle with the demon. That was actually one really cool thing they had at BlizzCon. They had a tiny little booth just set up with benches inside. And just randomly in the middle of the floor, but you go in there and they had all their cinematics just looping on this big, beautiful TV. It was really fun. Just kind of sat down for like an hour and watched all of them.
Very cool.
Should we move on?
Yeah, unless you guys have some more categories to share.
Well, I had heard mention of best voiceover, and
say
I love Patrick Stewart in Oblivion. Patrick Stewart can say anything, and I love it. I only remember like one commercial from when I was younger, but it's him narrating a tire commercial. And I remember the whole commercial just because I love Patrick Stewart's voice. So,
well, then you'd like any Star Trek game that he's been a part of, including Star Trek Legacy.
Oh, boy.
But for some reason, the voice work in Max Payne sticks with me. I mean, and it's not like a great performance, but it's atmospheric. You know, it really really fits in with the mood of the story they were trying to tell.
Mm-hmm. I think I would have to throw. I'm gonna have to go with an actor, Steve Blum, who is the intelligence officer in Company of Heroes. He's Cyrus in Dawn of War 2. He's Wolverine in basically any game with Wolverine in it, except for the one by Raven, I think. And, oh, what else is he? He's Spike in Cowboy Bebop, if you watch that anime as well. Oh, he's something else that I'm forgetting.
Yeah, just, I seem to recall having seen his name somewhere recently.
Yeah, very distinct and gravelly. Oh, he's a dwarf character, a dwarf character in Dragon Age. That's why I couldn't remember. It's been a while since I played it.
Hi, this is Derek calling from Georgetown, Ontario, Canada, and I'm with...
Ella.
I wanted to ask you guys a question. I want to pick up Street Fighter 4 for the PC. If I buy it on Steam, I have a greater access to a better Steam community, but I really, really want to support retail stores that are still carrying PC games. But I really, really despise the Microsoft games for Windows. What do I do? What should I do? Should I buy it for Steam? Should I buy it from a store? Anyway, thank you very much, and remember...
Be a PC gamer, don't be a lamer.
Goodbye.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Never gets old. Never gets old.
Well, let's see. As for the actual question, cuteness aside, if you really hate Games for Windows Live, then you're kind of out of luck, because it's going to use that no matter where you buy it.
Even on Steam, right?
Even on Steam, even when a Games for Windows Live game is put on Steam, they still use Games for Windows Live as the multiplayer component. You still have to log into that in some cases to save, which is awful. But that's kind of an irrelevant part of the decision if you want to buy it on PC. Unfortunately,
I think if you're interested in supporting Capcom for making what we think and what we judged in our review to be an excellent, excellent PC port in terms of the controls and the menus and whatnot, I would go to their store itself directly, shop.capcom.com, and buy it there.
But and if you want to support the smaller retailers that are still carrying PC Gamer or
indeed
any retailer, then there's no reason not to go to them. So I guess it depends on, if you want the retail portion of the purchase fee to go to your retailer, or do you want to go to Valve? That's the only question.
I really like the idea of buying it from the Capcom online store, though. That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah, or that.
All right, next question. Yes.
This is Bill, a.k.a. Rush Maniac from Long Island, New York. I was wondering if there's any comparable good games that are like Titan Quest or Diablo 2. I really like the hack and slash RPGs, and I can't wait till Diablo 3. So I was just wondering if there's anything that really good you guys recommend. Let me know. Thanks a lot. Love the podcast. Love the magazine. Take care.
Titan Quest is definitely my favorite in terms of something that's more graphically polished than Diablo, but has, co-op, up to 6 players, has a new setting that isn't strictly fantasy. Sacred 2 is the one that comes to mind. I can't remember exactly how we reviewed it, but...
Yeah, it did not review very well, mostly because there were a few bugs in it, and basically our reviewer felt that it was a little bit too much of a slog, like too much of enemies attacking you every single second, which some people like. So I'm pretty sure there's a demo, so you might want to check that out. It might just be a matter of personal taste on that one, I think. If that's what you really want, if you just want a constant, wave after wave of enemies hitting you, then that might be something you enjoy.
Space Siege? Question mark.
Space Siege, I mean, is that type of hack and slash thing. It's just not that good a game.
The only reason I bring that up is because if you pre-order Alpha Protocol, you get copy.
Yeah. On Steam.
Yeah, on Steam.
But and it's an okay game. I played all the way through it. It's just not very memorable or good in any particular way. It's just okay. It's kind of the definition of like the really average game.
Maybe that's maybe that's what he needs, just to get away from things.
But if he's looking for a fantasy setting, that's probably not the way to
go. Yeah.
What if we broaden the category here a little bit? I haven't played Evil Genius, Dan. I know it's a kind of a different genre there.
Completely different genre.
Okay. But it is $10 on GOG.com. I've always been curious about it.
Yeah, that's more of a Dungeon Keeper style game where you're not directly controlling anything. You're building a supervillain's labyrinth, like a underground layer within a volcano or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of control like your henchmen a little bit, but it's not like an RTS. Mm. It's certainly not a hack and slash RPG.
It's like a tycoon game, isn't it?
It's like Theme Hospital.
Sort of, kind of, yeah.
Evil Theme Hospital.
Except you're setting up traps to catch heroes that enter your lair and stuff. Yeah.
Well, sorry if we didn't answer. Good answer.
No, we gave him a recommendation. Check out the secret.
There just isn't a whole bunch, unfortunately.
I wish there were more, frankly. I can distinctly remember a couple weeks ago going through the Steam list and just like, man, give me another Titan Quest to play. Give me another one to play. Like, I just need something along those lines sometimes. Baldur's Gate, to some extent. It's not as open, but and it is older. But
yeah, you know, actually, there's one game I'm thinking of here. I've almost got it here. I think it's, Silverfall.
Oh, yeah.
It got 72% rated by none other than Deslock. But it's, you know, it might be a fun action RPG for you if you can dig that one up. It was published by Atari, developed by Monte Cristo. And that was from June 07. So, yeah, you might be able to find that one somewhere. I don't think
also, Dungeon Siege, if he hasn't played it.
Oh, there you go.
Good series.
Yeah. What did we think of Space Siege and not Dungeon Siege? Thank you, Josh.
My pleasure.
Cool. All right, there you go. A handful of excellent recommendations.
Hi, PC Gamer. I enjoy listening to your podcast every week. I was wondering what type of mouses you guys use and whether it's a gaming mouse or just a regular office mouse, and if you think having a gaming mouse makes any difference. Thank you.
Definitely makes a difference. Oh my goodness, yes.
Yes,
if you play shooters
or RTSs,
I swear by my mouse. I've got the G5 with the weights. I love the weights. I love that customization. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, the Logitech G5 that was my favorite until the Microsoft Sidewinder, which I currently use. The it fits my hand really well. I have a big hand, so I love the vertical arrangement of the thumb buttons and the nice clicky wide scroll wheel, just really nice. And you know, I've never really been a DPI whore on mice.
No, me neither. Not at all.
Yeah, no. I mean, to me, it doesn't seem to make that much difference. I generally tend to set them when they have adjustable DPI. I tend to set it somewhat low because I like the mouse to move quickly. If it's a high DPI, unless you then go into the game and turn the mouse sensitivity way up, then the mouse starts to move kind of sluggishly because there's like more gradation as you move. So, Josh, what do you use?
I'm using the same Microsoft Sidewinder. I love it.
Oh, that's right. I gave that to you.
Yes, you did.
Glad to hear you're liking it.
I mean, I don't even just recommend gaming mice for games. I recommend it for everyday use because I can't use a normal mouse to do editing and stuff. Like, no way. I have to have a mouse that fits my hand perfectly and works well.
And although when it boils down to it, there's no real difference between a gaming mouse and a nice ergonomic mouse of any for office work. I mean, there's no real difference there.
I'm talking about mice that just like come with a PC or something. Like usually they are actually inaccurate or don't work very well. For me, like
sometimes, a really cheap mouse will be kind of all over the map.
Yeah, like I've noticed, even when I jump on a coworker's machine to do something, I'm like, I cannot even like get anywhere near where I need to be. You know,
well that could be sensitivity settings, though.
It could be just because you're on a Mac too, and they have a crappy mouse.
Well, and it could just that's probably not. And Mac mice are probably pretty nice. I mean, I don't use them that much, but I've really had a problem with
ones. Not like not, Mac, not since
the
Mighty
not
mouse.
Since the. Yeah, not since the hockey puck mouse have I had a problem with the Mac mouse. Evan, I noticed on your screen there you had that new crazy mouse. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, Razer.
Oh, the 19 button one or whatever.
Yeah, they just announced it last week. We forgot to talk about it. It's called the Naga gaming PC mouse for MMOs. So it looks like a, you know, I guess like the Salmosa and the Death Adder to some extent. It's a little bit like fatter at the base toward the palm. But there are 12 thumb buttons. Almost like a numpad arranged on the side there.
I don't know how you could know which one you're hitting without moving your thumb, looking.
I mean, why not just do 8 or 9 and just have them stand out a little bit better?
Why not just use the keyboard? Sorry, Josh, what'd you say?
You can't comfortably move around those 12 buttons. There's no way with your one thumb to move, hit all 12 without like really stretching it at some point.
Well, the issue for me is, where is your thumb going to go when it's not on those buttons? Because I wouldn't want to just hover all the time over them, right?
You'd kind of have to. And based on, I mean, they're all right where you put your thumb. And yeah. I guess maybe you'd get used to it, like somebody who can text by touch on their cell phone, like their you know, cell phone that doesn't have a QWERTY keyboard. But yeah, I mean, it would be a nightmare. I can't imagine that would be preferable to getting rather than getting something like the Logitech G15 keyboard that has, you know, a whole set of macro keys on the left.
Honestly, this does look like a cell phone. Like you were just talking about that. You could hold this up to your ear and press the buttons just like a cell phone. They should have a mic built into it.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, either way.
Wait, one more quick question for you guys about mice. Just because I never use weights in my mice, do you guys use weights or kind of fine tune it? Does that really make a difference?
I love my weighted mouse. I think it's perfect for what my wrist needs, you know, to feel the right amount of drag and not too much weight. Because I know that I have basically two mice in my life. I have the one
fashion time.
Yeah, I have the one at work, which it fits my head really well, but it's too light. I would prefer a heavier mouse, but I can't change it, right? But I've got the one at home that I use for gaming and stuff, and that one is perfectly weighted. So, yeah, it totally makes a difference.
Do you know off the top of your head what level of weight you put in there?
It's not very much at all. I can eject my little thingy. I've only got like you know how you can eject the little cartridge?
Right. Yeah.
I've only got like half of them filled with weights.
So, like six grams or something, maybe.
I can't really do the, less. 10, like 13 grams total.
Whoa.
Now on mine, on the Sidewinder, it also has, at least the original version of the Sidewinder, also has, you know, an ejectable, weight cartridge. Mine, I always max it out because I, for some reason, I just like a heavy mouse. I even like wireless mice because they have the battery weight in them, although the connection isn't always the best. But this one I've got, I guess, 30 grams in it.
Wow.
30 grams? Wow. Yeah.
Whoa.
That amount of cocaine would definitely get you arrested in the United States. Next question.
All right.
Hi, PCG, as your fans have dubbed you. Chris in Utica again. I'm looking at the Diablo 3 screens from BlizzCon. And I certainly must say that my opinion of the art style has been remolded. Now, to be clear, I'm a big hater when it comes to the World of Warcraft visuals. I mean, it looks like a baby's toy. But when I thought the same about the first Diablo 3 shots back in June of 08, I now realize that I was being a little bit hasty. I mean, it doesn't look child-friendly by any means. The color palette doesn't come off as too vibrant or cartoonish. It looks great. Now, I'm willing to admit that I just didn't see enough of the game that first time around. I don't know if Blizzard decided to make any tweaks in response to the criticisms that arose. Do you guys think the visuals look different enough to speculate on that? Or do you think they just look more fleshed out? If the change I'm seeing is just the more, you know, evolved look of the game, then do you think that they showed the game a little bit too early at last year's event, considering, you know, the less than ignorable level of criticism that arose in response to the visuals? Thanks for the podcast.
Well, I have one quick thing to say. We talked with some of the guys there, you know, interviewing about Diablo 3. And one of the questions we asked was, you know, I mean, seeing it in action, it's an incredibly gory game, incredibly violent, bloody. I mean, it's just the attacks have such force and power and the knockback. It's just really, really powerful. And so we asked him, you know, have you ever had to tone back the game, you know, because you want it to be more kid-friendly or anything? And they thought about it for a little bit, and no, they said, the only thing they've been told is, you know, make it more. They've never been told to kind of rear back and hold back on it. So I would say, if anything, yeah, they've definitely improved it to be, I guess, as he said, you know, adult focused.
Well, and I don't think he's talking mostly about the blood. I mean, there was always blood in it, right? Even in the introductory video, there was plenty of blood to go around. But just the backgrounds and stuff like that. People were complaining that they were too bright and that armor looked too cartoony and stuff like that. I think that he's probably right in that, you know, they only saw one section of the game, one brief, very brief section of the game. And, you know, Blizzard immediately came out and said, hey, that's just one of our many, many settings. You know, wait a little while. You'll see a lot of darker, more creepy stuff, but this is just what was ready to go right now. So I think, I don't think they showed it too early. I think the fans reacted too hastily, honestly. I mean, it's just because, you know, just one little slice of a Blizzard game in particular. I mean, reacting like that to that level of vitriol was a little bit crazy. And crazy might be too strong a word, but overly passionate and rushing to judgment.
But Dan, there was a rainbow in one of the screens.
I know, it's outrageous.
An actual rainbow in a Diablo game. I'll definitely agree with you that it was, you know, way, I mean, again, it's this kind of message board rhetoric, right? Where for a gamer that's, you know, hardcore into these games, they want to sort of give this impression that they know things more quickly than other people, and that they can judge them more quickly than other people, and that somehow makes them a better gamer or a more informed gamer. And I don't think that's the case, you know? Just wait until you've seen more of the experience and you have a better idea of what something fully is. They had only announced like two classes up until that point anyway.
But it's just kind of a no-win situation because, I mean, at that point in development, you know, the game is not done. It's not ready to for prime time, so to speak. It's everything is still in progress. The art can still be in progress, but people are clamoring to see it. And if you don't show it to them, they're like, why aren't you showing it to us? It must suck, you know? And if you do show it, it's like, well, it looks like crap. But of course it's not done, you know? So there's really no winning situation there. They didn't show it too early. It's just, they showed what they had at the time.
Yeah. I would really quickly just politely disagree that they didn't, you know, knowing now that the game isn't going to come out in 2010, almost definitely, that they might have announced it a little bit early. If it's coming out in 2011, that's 2 years ahead of time.
So I mean, lots of games are 2 years
actually
announced
two and
years
a half.
In advance. Yeah. And there are plenty of games that have been like that. I mean, how long in advance did we hear about Dragon Age? I mean, that one was way longer than 2.5 years. That one's been in the works a long time. I think Fallout 3 was about that long. I think Spore was longer than that. Star Wars The Old Republic will probably end up being about that long. Left 4 Dead, probably about that long. I think that's pretty standard length of time, really.
It's standard, but I don't know if it for this type of game, just for me personally. I like shorter lead for my anticipation of games. I don't like to be strung along because I really want to play Diablo 3. We were just talking about hack and slashers and how there's a relative void of them recently. It just makes me want that type of game even more and get really anxious and frustrated, honestly.
All right. Well, I mean, they do have to, you know, scale up their marketing machine. And, you know, they want to keep awareness of it and then build and build and build. So it's, you know, it depends on their marketing strategy, really.
So, Dan, what you been playing?
Like I said, I just played Monkey Island Part 2, which was excellent.
Me too.
I thought it was maybe a little bit even better than the first one.
Yeah, totally. I agree.
Wow.
The puzzles were a little bit smoother. I had less of a. I didn't hit as many walls, so it was a little bit more intuitive. There was one in particular that stumped me in the first one for longer than I would have liked. So it got a little bit frustrating, whereas this one I was never frustrated. I was just enjoying myself the whole time. As a result, it took a little bit less time to play through, but I'm okay with that. While I'm talking, I wanted to make a quick correction, an apology. Last week I said that that in Guild Wars 2 they hadn't made clear that they were not going to be charging a subscription fee, but in fact they had. I was just stupid. So. It will be the same business model as the last one where, you buy the game and you can play it online for free forever.
Nice. That's really reassuring and cool. Josh Augustine, what have you been doing outside of BlizzCon?
Playing World of Warcraft still, of course, been doing Arena. It's been really fun. All my buddies are down in Anaheim, so while I was down in BlizzCon, I stopped by their house. We had a little mini Arena session. It's really good. And, playing League of Legends and loving it more and more every time. I'm playing the pirate captain, which is awesome. He has a ship off screen that you can order to bombard certain areas, and he has scurvy until he eats oranges, and then it like removes debuffs when you remove scurvy.
I was saying to you on the drive to lunch yesterday, like, I love that they went with that over the top sort of style, you know, like characters that have a constant scurvy debuff until they eat fruit. Okay, that's your mechanic, you know, for that character. It's just you know, bringing in that nonsense. I guess as a contrast to Demigod, because we play a lot of Demigod, it makes it more interesting for me.
Yeah, I mean, and I think with, you know, how many 20-something odd champions they're going to end up having, I mean, it's a really great choice for that, because it really helps differentiate it with, like, style and flavor, not necessarily different abilities, too.
Most definitely. Next, Andy Bauman.
Well, yeah, I sort of lumped mine into Dan's. I've been playing Monkey Island, Tales of Monkey Island, Episode 2, Siege of Spinner K. So it's awesome, and everybody should try. No, I love it so much. I don't know. I just find myself thinking, like, I can't believe they made a new Monkey Island thing, and it's this good. It makes my life like, so complete.
I thought it was pretty funny. I mean, do you think it was as funny or less funny or funnier than the first one?
Yeah, no, it's definitely it's definitely got, like, more of a – it's cooler because there's certain story things that are going on that you're like, this is awesome. Like, the whole LeChuck thing is great.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. They have kind of a LeChuck
and they have, like, a self-aware rivalry. It's like postmodern. It's great.
Right.
Postmodern, come on.
Okay, sorry. I use that as, like, they do some, like, meta jokes that are funny as hell, and they work cool. So well.
It's post-Monkey Island is what it is.
Yes. The secret of Donkey Island, which you do find out if you ask.
Now I'm just confused. Yes. I'm going to move on to my own playlist.
Okay.
I've been finally getting back into Dawn of War 2, which I've been wanting to finish up, and for whatever reason, I haven't been able to, and I'm sort of now just getting into the end game. I think my guys are around level 15 or 16, and really enjoying doing the single player at my own pace, and again, you know, those Space Marines have got to be some of the best action figures in gaming, I think.
Yeah, just to throw off your enjoyment of playing it by yourself, I want to play some co-op in that campaign. I haven't played it in a long time, and it was just a lot of fun to coordinate some attacks. I think we should get in on that and play some of that this weekend.
Yeah, let's do it. That sounds great to me.
However, we also have to practice our demigod.
Oh, thank you so much for reminding me of that, Dan. So, listeners of the podcast, you know, circa 2 months ago, may remember that we played Gaspar Games at their own game, Demigod. And, you know, within, was it three matches or two? I can't remember.
I think we played two full matches.
And, you know, crushed them completely. We died once and killed them, you know, 30 or something times. It was a wipe. It was a wipeout.
Across both games, yeah.
Yeah. It was fantastic.
There was one game where we shut them out. They got no kills, and we got something like 25 kills. Yeah.
It was delightful. But so recently, Brad Wardell, CEO of Stardock, came up to visit us here at PC Gamer, and we were talking about some new stuff that Impulse has going on, et cetera, et cetera. And we mentioned that we beat GPG, and he wanted to challenge us to a rematch, basically on behalf of the game, from people at Stardock, which he claims are somehow better at the game. I'm sort of skeptical about that, but we'll see. And we're set to play them probably this Tuesday.
Yeah, this coming Tuesday. It's on.
Are you going to be recording it?
We're going to try. Demigod has some problems with the recording feature right now. They're supposed to add like a good like recording feature in the 1.2 patch, which is not yet out. But we'll see what we can do. We'll at least take some screenshots.
Do you think they'll conveniently wait to patch that in until after you guys fight, so their shame won't be recorded?
I don't know. They're talking a lot of smack. They think they've got a shot, but we'll have to dissuade them of that idea.
Yeah, it's been surprising. We'll let you guys know how it goes next week, for sure. Hopefully in our favor. All right, that looks like it about wraps it up for us this week. Thanks for joining us, guys. As a reminder, please feel free to visit PCGamer.com if you'd like to subscribe to our magazine. And if you'd like to submit a question for next week, give us a ring at 877-404-1337, extension 724. Or as always, you can submit a question via email at PCGamerPodcast@gmail.com as an MP3 file. Thanks a lot, guys. And feel free to give us your favorite or best developer, your favorite game with Ragdoll, your favorite jetpack in a game. Share that with us in the comments. We definitely want to hear. And we'll see you next week.
Oh, you can also follow us on Twitter at PC Gamer or on Facebook at facebook.com/PC Gamer Magazine. Did you mute?
The cover lines are so, like, where's the rest of the magazine? It's at the top.
And Evan's talking about something completely unrelated.
Magazine talk. Ooh, yep. Sexy.
All right,
can
fantastic.
You say they have croc butter to put on those shoes to keep them looking good? Croc butter. That is the most gross-sounding thing I've ever heard.
You faded away again, Josh. Sorry.
Oh. Is that any better?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Croc butter just got me so angry.
I understand.
As it should.
Josh, what'd you do?
That was me. I just turned my mic up a little bit. Hold on.
Did you jump in the river? Get out of the stream.
Swim.
Do you just want to try recalling, Andy?
Yeah. Oh, wait. It subsided.
Went away.
Yeah, it went away for the moment.
I'll recall, though. Just for good measure.
Total recall.